runs of their own kind. Like with like, or rather, superficially like with superficially like. All the hearts together, all the clubs together, all the Sudanese, all the Hondurans. Say the Nadia did not move, but their house began to change nonetheless. Nigerians were initially the largest among many groups of residents, but every so often a non-Nigerian family would relocate out of the house, and their place would almost always be taken by more Nigerians. And so the house began to be known as a Nigerian house, like the two on either side. The elder Nigerians of these three houses would meet in the garden of the property to the right of Seyda Nadia's, and this meeting they called the Council. Women and men both attended, but the only obvious non-Nigerian who attended was Nadia. The first time Nadia went, the others seemed surprised to see her, not merely because of her ethnicity, but because of her relatively young age. Momentarily there was a silence, but then an old woman with a turban who lived with her daughter and grandsons in the bedroom above Seyda Nadia's, and whom Nadia had helped on more than one occasion to ascend the stairs, the old woman being regal in posture, but also quite large. This old woman motioned to Nadia, beckoned Nadia to come stand at her side, to stand beside the garden chair on which she was sitting. This seemed to settle the matter, and Nadia was not questioned or asked to leave. Initially, Nadia did not follow much of what was being said, just snippets here and there. But over time, she understood more and more, and she understood also that the Nigerians were in fact not all Nigerians. Some were half Nigerians, or from places that bordered Nigeria, from families that spanned both sides of a border. And further, that there was perhaps no such thing as a Nigerian, or certainly no one common thing, for different Nigerians spoke different tongues among themselves and belonged to different religions. Together in this group, they conversed in a language that was built in large part from English, but not solely from English. And some of them were, in any case, more familiar with English than were others. Also, they spoke different variations of English, different Englishes. And so when Nadia gave voice to an idea or opinion among them, she did not need to fear that her views could not be comprehended, for her English was like theirs, one among many. The activities of the council were mundane, making decisions on room disputes or claims of theft or unneighborly behavior, and also on relations with other houses on the street. Deliberations were often slow and cumbersome, so these gatherings were not particularly thrilling. And yet Nadia looked forward to them. They represented something new in her mind, the birth of something new, and she found these people, who were both like and unlike those she had known in her city, familiar and unfamiliar, she found them interesting, and she found their seeming acceptance of her, or at least tolerance of her, rewarding, an achievement in a way. Among the younger Nigerians, Nadia acquired a bit of a special status, perhaps because they saw her with their elders, or perhaps because of her black robe. And so the younger Nigerian men and women, and the older Nigerian boys and girls, the ones who often had quick jibes to make about many of the others in the house, rarely said anything of that nature to her, or about her, at least in her presence. She came and went unruffled through the crowded rooms and passages, unruffled except by a fast-talking Nigerian woman her own age, a woman with a leather jacket and a chipped tooth, who stood like a gunslinger, with hips open and belt loose and hands at her sides, and spared no one from her verbal lashings, from her comments that would follow you even as you passed her and left her behind. Seyd, though, was less comfortable. As he was a young man, the other young men would size him up from time to time, as young men do, and Seyd found this disconcerting. Not because he had not encountered anything similar in his own country. He had. But because here in this house, he was the only man from his country, and those sizing him up were from another country, and there were far more of them, and he was alone. This touched upon something basic, something tribal, and evoked tension and a sort of suppressed fear. He was uncertain when he could relax, if he could relax. And so when he was outside his bedroom, but inside the house, he seldom felt fully at ease. Once he was alone, arriving home while Nadia was at a meeting of the council, and the woman in the leather jacket stood in the hall, blocking his way with her narrow, jagged form, her back leaning against one wall, a foot planted on the other. Say did not like to admit it, but he was intimidated by her intensity, and by the speed and unpredictability of her words, words that he often could not understand, but words that made others laugh. He stood there and waited for her to move, to yield space for him to pass, but she did not move, and so he said, "Excuse me," and she said, "Why should I excuse you?" She said more than that, but all he could catch was that phrase. Said was angry that she was toying with him, and alarmed also, and he considered turning around and coming back later. But he realized at that moment that there was a man behind him, a tough-looking Nigerian man. Said had heard that this man had a gun, though he could not see it on him, but many of the migrants in Dark London had taken to carrying knives and other weapons, being as they were in a state of siege and liable to be attacked by government forces at any time, or in some cases being predisposed to carrying weapons, having done it where they came from, and so continuing to do it here, which Said suspected was the case with this man. Said wanted to run, but had nowhere to run to, and tried to hide his panic. But then the woman in the leather jacket removed her foot from the wall, and there was space for Said to pass, and so he squeezed through, brushing her body with his, and feeling emasculated as he did so. And when he was alone in his and Nadia's room, he sat on the bed and his heart was racing, and he wanted to shout and to huddle in a corner, but of course he did neither. Around a bend on Vicarage Gate was a house known to be a house of people from his country. Said began to spend more time there, drawn by the familiar languages and accents and the familiar smell of the cooking. One afternoon he was there at prayer time, and he joined his fellow countrymen in prayer in the back garden, under a blue sky that seemed shockingly blue, like the sky of another world, absent the airborne dust of the city where he had spent his entire life, and also peering out into space from a higher latitude, a different perch on the spinning earth, nearer its pole than its equator, and so glimpsing the void from a different angle, a bluer angle. And as he prayed, he felt praying was different here, somehow, in the garden of this house, with these men. It made him feel part of something, not just something spiritual, but something human, part of this group. And for a wrenchingly painful second, he thought of his father, and then a bearded man with two white marks in the black on either side of his chin, marks like those of a great cat or wolf, put his arm around Said and said, "Brother, would you like some tea?" That day, Said felt he was really accepted by this house, and he thought he could ask the man with the white marked beard if there was space there for him and Nadia, whom he called his wife. The man said there was always space for a brother and sister, though sadly not a room they could share. But Said could stay with him and some other men on the floor of the living room, provided, that is, he did not mind sleeping on the floor. And Nadia could stay upstairs with the women. Unfortunately, even he and his own wife were split up in this manner, and they were among the first residents, but it was the only civilized way to cram as many people into the house as they had managed to do, as was righteous to do. When Said told Nadia this good news, she did not act like it was good news at all. "Why would we want to move?" she said. "To be among our own kind," Said answered. "What makes them our kind?" "They're from our country, from the country we used to be from." "Yes," Said tried not to sound annoyed. "We've left that place. That doesn't mean we have no connection. They're not like me." "You haven't met them." "I don't need to." She released a long, taut breath. "Here we have our own room," she said, softening her tone. "Just the two of us. It's a big luxury. Why would we give that up to sleep apart among dozens of strangers?" Said had no answer for this. Considering it later, he thought it was indeed odd that he would want to give up their bedroom for a pair of separated spaces with a barrier between them, as when they lived in his parents' home, a time he now thought of fondly in a way, despite the horrors, fondly in terms of how he had felt for Nadia and she had felt for him, how they had felt together. He did not press the point, but when Nadia brought her face close to his in bed that night, close enough to tickle his lips with her breathing, he was unable to muster the enthusiasm to bridge the tiny distance it would have taken to kiss. Every day, a flight of fighter aircraft would streak through the sky, screaming a reminder to the people of dark London of the technological superiority of their opponents, of the government and nativist forces. At the borders of their locality, Seyed and Nadia could occasionally glimpse tanks and armored vehicles and communication arrays and robots that walked or crawled like animals, bearing loads for soldiers or rehearsing the disarming of explosives or perhaps preparing to do some other unknown task. Even more than the fighter planes and the tanks, these robots, few though they were, and the drones overhead, were frightening because they suggested an unstoppable efficiency, an inhuman power, and evoked the kind of dread that a small mammal feels before a predator of an altogether different order, like a rodent before a snake. In meetings of the council, Nadia listened as the elders discussed what to do when the operation finally came. All agreed that the most important thing was to manage the impetuousness of the youngsters, for armed resistance would likely lead to a slaughter, and nonviolence was surely the most potent response, shaming their attackers into civility. All agreed on this except Nadia, who was unsure what she thought, who had seen what happens to people who surrender, as her former city surrendered to the militants, and who thought that the young people with their guns and their knives and their fists and their teeth were entitled to use these things, and that the ferocity of the little was sometimes all that kept them safe from the predations of the big. But there was wisdom in what the elders said too, and so she was unsure. Seyed also was unsure, but in the nearby house of his fellow countryfolk, the man with the white-marked beard spoke of martyrdom, not as the most desirable outcome, but as one possible end of a path the right-minded had no other choice but to follow, and advocated a banding together of migrants along religious principles, cutting across divisions of race or language or nation. For what did those divisions matter now in a world full of doors? The only divisions that mattered now were between those who sought the right of passage and those who would deny them passage. And in such a world, the religion of the righteous must defend those who sought passage. Seyed was torn because he was moved by these words, strengthened by them, and they were not the barbarous words of the militants back home, the militants because of whom his mother was dead, and possibly by now his father as well. But at the same time, the gathering of men drawn to the words of the man with the white-marked beard sporadically did remind him of the militants, and when he thought this, he felt something rancid in himself, like he was rotting from within. There were guns in the house of his fellow countryfolk, more arriving each day through the doors. Seyed accepted a pistol, but not a rifle, since he could conceal it, and in his heart, he would not have been able to say if he took the pistol because it would make him safer from the nativists or from the Nigerians, his own neighbors. As he undressed that night, he did not speak of it, but also he did not hide it from Nadia, and upon seeing the pistol, he thought she would fight with him, or at least argue, for he knew what the council had decided. But she did not do so. Instead, she watched him, and he looked at her, and he saw her animal form, the strangeness of her face and her body, and she saw the strangeness of his, and when he reached for her, she came to him. Came to him, though she moved slightly away, and there was a mutual violence and excitement to their coupling, a kind of shocked, almost painful surprise. Only after Nadia had fallen asleep, and Seyed lay there in the moonlight that crept between and around the blinds, did he consider that he had no idea how to use or maintain a pistol, not the faintest clue, beyond the fact that pulling the trigger should make it fire. He realized he was being ridiculous and must return it the very next day. A thriving trade in electricity was underway in dark London, run by those who lived in pockets with power. and say that Nadia were able to recharge their phones from time to time, and if they walked at the edges of their locality, they could pick up a strong signal. And so, like many others, they caught up with the world in this way. And once, as Nadia sat on the steps of a building, reading the news on her phone, across the street from a detachment of troops and a tank, she thought she saw online a photograph of herself, sitting on the steps of a building, reading the news on her phone, across the street from a detachment of troops and a tank. And she was startled and wondered how this could be, how she could both read this news and be this news, and how the newspaper could have published this image of her instantaneously. And she looked about for a photographer, and she had the bizarre feeling of time bending all around her, as though she was from the past, reading about the future, or from the future, reading about the past. And she almost felt that if she got up and walked home at this moment, there would be two Nadias, that she would split into two Nadias, and one would stay on the steps reading, and one would walk home. And two different lives would unfold for these two different selves. And she thought she was losing her balance, or possibly her mind. And then she zoomed in on the image and saw that the woman in the black robe reading the news on her phone was actually not her at all. The news in those days was full of war and migrants and nativists. And it was full of fracturing too, of regions pulling away from nations and cities pulling away from hinterlands. And it seemed that as everyone was coming together, everyone was also moving apart. Without borders, nations appeared to be becoming somewhat illusory, and people were questioning what role they had to play. Many were arguing that smaller units made more sense, but others argued that smaller units could not defend themselves. Reading the news at that time, one was tempted to conclude that the nation was like a person with multiple personalities, some insisting on union and some on disintegration, and that this person with multiple personalities was furthermore a person whose skin appeared to be dissolving as they swam in a soup full of other people whose skins were likewise dissolving. Even Britain was not immune from this phenomenon. In fact, some said Britain had already split, like a man whose head had been chopped off and yet still stood, and others said Britain was an island, and islands endure, even if the people who come to them change. And so it had been for millennia, and so it would be for millennia more. The fury of those nativists advocating wholesale slaughter was what struck Nadia most, and it struck her because it seemed so familiar, so much like the fury of the militants in her own city. She wondered whether she and Saeed had done anything by moving, whether the faces and buildings had changed, but the basic reality of their predicament had not. But then around her, she saw all these people of all these different colors, in all these different attires, and she was relieved. Better here than there, she thought. And it occurred to her that she had been stifled in the place of her birth for virtually her entire life, that its time for her had passed, and a new time was here. And, fraught or not, she relished this, like the wind in her face on a hot day when she rode her motorcycle and lifted the visor of her helmet and embraced the dust and the pollution and the little bugs that sometimes went into your mouth and made you recoil and even spit, but after spitting, grin, and grin with a wildness. For others, too, the doors came as a release. In the hills above Tijuana was an orphanage called simply the House of the Children, perhaps because it was not precisely an orphanage, or not only an orphanage, though that is what it was referred to by the college students from across the border who would sometimes come here to do volunteer work, painting, carpentry, the hanging and spackling of drywall. But many of the children in the House of the Children had at least one living parent or sibling or uncle or aunt. Usually, these relatives labored on the other side, in the United States, and their absences would last until the child was old enough to attempt the crossing, or until the relative was exhausted enough to return, or on occasion, quite often, forever, because life and its end are unpredictable, especially at a distance, where death seems to operate with such whimsical aim. The house sat on a ridge at the crest of a hill, fronting a street. Its chain-link fenced and partly concrete-floored play area was at the back, facing a parched valley, on which the other low dwellings of that street also opened, some of them rising on stilts, as though jutting out to sea, an effect that was incongruous, given the dryness and lack of water all about. But the Pacific Ocean was only a couple hours' walk to the west, and besides, stilts made sense, given the terrain. Out of a black door in a nearby cantina, admittedly an atypical place for a young woman like herself to be found, a young woman was emerging. The owner made no fuss over it, for the times were such, and once this young woman had emerged, she rose and strode to the orphanage. There she located another young woman, or rather a grown girl, and the young woman hugged the girl, whom she recognized only because she had seen her on electronic displays, on the screens of phones and computers, it having been that many years. And the girl hugged her mother, and then became shy. The girl's mother met the adults who ran the orphanage, and many of the children, who stared at her, and chattered as though she was a sign of something, which of course she was, since if she had come, then others would come too. Dinner that evening was rice and refried beans served on paper plates, eaten on an unbroken row of tables flanked by benches, and the mother sat at the center like a dignitary or a holy figure, and told stories that some of the children, being children, imagined happening to their own mothers, now or before, when their mothers were still alive. The mother who had returned on this day spent the night at the orphanage so her daughter could say her farewells, and then mother and daughter walked together to the cantina, and the owner allowed them in, shaking his head but smiling as well, the smile bending his mustache and making his fierce visage somewhat goofy for a moment. And with that, the mother and her daughter were gone. In London, Said and Nadia heard that military and paramilitary formations had fully mobilized and deployed in the city from all over the country. They imagined British regiments with ancient names and modern kit standing ready to cut through any resistance that might be encountered. A great massacre, it seemed, was in the offing. Both of them knew that the Battle of London would be hopelessly one-sided, and like many others, they no longer ventured far from their home. The operation to clear the migrant ghetto in which Said and Nadia found themselves began badly, with a police officer shot in the leg within seconds as his unit moved into an occupied cinema near Marble Arch. And then the flat sounds of a firefight commenced, coming from there but also from elsewhere, growing and growing, all around. And Said, who was caught in the open, ran back to the house and found the heavy front door locked shut, and he banged on it until it opened, Nadia yanking him in and slamming it behind him. They went to their room in the back and pushed their mattress up against the window and sat together in one corner and waited. They heard helicopters and more shooting, an announcement to peacefully vacate the area made over speakers so powerful that they shook the floor. And they saw through the gap between mattress and window thousands of leaflets dropping from the sky. And after a while they saw smoke and smelled burning, and then it was quiet. But the smoke and the smell lasted a long time, particularly the smell, lingering even when the wind direction changed. That night, a rumor spread that over 200 migrants had been incinerated when the cinema burned down, children and women and men, but especially children, so many children. And whether or not this was true, or any of the other rumors, of a bloodbath in Hyde Park, or in Earl's Court, or near the Shepherd's Bush roundabout, migrants dying in their scores. Whatever it was that had happened, something seemed to have happened, for there was a pause, and the soldiers and police officers and volunteers who had advanced into the outer edges of the ghetto pulled back, and there was no more shooting that night. The next day was quiet, and the day after that, and on the second day of quiet, Said and Nadia removed the mattress from their window and dared to venture outside and forage for food, but there was none to be found. The depots and soup kitchens were shut. Some supplies were coming through the doors, but not nearly enough. The council met and requisitioned all provisions in the three houses, and these were rationed, with most going to the children, and Said and Nadia getting a handful of almonds each one day, and a tin of herring to share the next. They sat on their bed and watched the rain and talked as they often did about the end of the world, and Said wondered aloud, once again, if the natives would really kill them, And Nadia said, once again, that the natives were so frightened that they could do anything. I can understand it, she said. Imagine if you lived here, and millions of people from all over the world suddenly arrived. Millions arrived in our country, Said replied, when there were wars nearby. That was different. Our country was poor. We didn't feel we had as much to lose. Outside on the balcony, the rain clattered in pots and pans, and periodically, Said or Nadia would get up and open the window and carry two of these to the bathroom and empty them into the stoppered tub, which the council had designated part of the house's emergency water supply, now that the taps had run dry. Nadia watched Said and not for the first time wondered if she had led him astray. She thought maybe he had in the end been wavering about leaving their city, and she thought maybe she could have tipped him either way, and she thought he was basically a good and decent man, and she was filled with compassion for him in that instant, as she observed his face with its gaze upon the rain, and she realized she had not in her life felt so strongly for anyone in the world as she had for Said in the moments of those first months when she had felt most strongly for him. Said, for his part, wished he could do something for Nadia, could protect her from what would come, even if he understood, at some level, that to love is to enter into the inevitability of one day not being able to protect what is most valuable to you. He thought she deserved better than this, but he could see no way out, for they had decided not to run, not to play roulette with yet another departure. To flee forever is beyond the capacity of most. At some point, even a hunted animal will stop, exhausted, and await its fate, if only for a while. What do you think happens when you die? Nadia asked him. You mean the afterlife? No, not after. When? In the moment. Do things just go black? Like a phone screen turning off? Or do you slip into something strange in the middle, like when you're falling asleep and you're both here and there? Said thought it depended on how you died, but he saw Nadia seeing him, so intent on his answer, and he said, I think it would be like falling asleep. You'd dream before you were gone. It was all the protection he could offer her then, and she smiled at this, a warm, bright smile, and he wondered if she believed him, or if she thought, no, dearest, that is not what you think at all. But a week passed, and then another. And then the natives and their forces stepped back from the brink. Perhaps they had decided they did not have it in them to do what would have needed to be done, to corral and bloody and, where necessary, slaughter the migrants, and had determined that some other way would have to be found. Perhaps they had grasped that the doors could not be closed, and new doors would continue to open, and they had understood that the denial of coexistence would have required one party to cease to exist, and the extinguishing party too would have been transformed in the process, and too many native parents would not after have been able to look their children in the eye, to speak with head held high of what their generation had done. Or perhaps the sheer number of places where there were now doors had made it useless to fight in any one. And so, irrespective of the reason, decency on this occasion won out, and bravery, for courage is demanded not to attack when afraid, and the electricity and water came on again, and negotiations ensued, and word spread, and among the cherry trees on Palace Gardens Terrace, Said and Nadia and their neighbors celebrated. They celebrated long into the night. Chapter 9. That summer, it seemed to Said and Nadia that the whole planet was on the move. Much of the global south headed to the global north, but also southerners moving to other southern places, and northerners moving to other northern places. In the formerly protected green belt around London, a ring of new cities was being built, cities that would be able to accommodate more people again than London itself. This development was called the London Halo, one of innumerable human halos and satellites and constellations springing up in the country and in the world. It was here that Said and Nadia found themselves in those warmer months, in one of the worker camps, laboring away. In exchange for their labor in clearing terrain and building infrastructure and assembling dwellings from prefabricated blocks, migrants were promised 40 meters and a pipe, a home on 40 square meters of land, and a connection to all the utilities of modernity. A mutually agreed time tax had been enacted, such that a portion of the income and toil of those who had recently arrived on the island would go to those who had been there for decades. And this time tax was tapered in both directions, becoming a smaller and smaller sliver as one continued to reside, and then a larger and larger subsidy thereafter. Disruptions were enormous, and conflict did not vanish overnight. It persisted and simmered, but reports of its persistence and simmering seemed less than apocalyptic. And while some migrants continued to cling to properties they did not own under the law, and some migrants and some nativists too continued to detonate bombs and carry out knifings and shootings, Sayed and Nadia had the sense that overall, for most people, in Britain at least, existence went on in tolerable safety. Sayed and Nadia's worker camp was bounded by a perimeter fence. Inside this were large pavilions of a grayish fabric that looked like plastic, supported by metal trusses in such a way that each reared up and was airy within and was resistant to the wind and rain. The two of them occupied a small curtained-off space in one of these dormitories, the curtain suspended from cables that ran almost as high as Sayed could reach, above which was empty space, as though the lower part of the pavilion was an open-topped maze or the operating rooms of a huge field hospital. They ate modestly, meals composed of grains and vegetables and some dairy, and when they were lucky, juiced fruit or a little meat. They were slightly hungry, yes, but slept well because the labor was lengthy and rigorous. The first dwellings that the workers of their camp had built were almost ready to be occupied, and Sayed and Nadia were not too far down the list, and so by the end of autumn, they could look forward to moving into a home of their own. Their blisters had given way to calluses, and the rain did not much bother them anymore. One night, as Nadia slept on their cot beside Sayed, she had a dream of the girl from Mykonos, and she dreamt that she had returned to the house they had first arrived at in London, and had gone upstairs and passed back through the door to the Greek Isle. And when Nadia woke, she was almost panting and felt her body alive or alarmed, regardless changed, for the dream had seemed so real. And after that, she found herself thinking of Mykonos from time to time. For his part, Sayed often had dreams of his father, whose death had been reported to Sayed by a cousin who had recently managed to escape from their city, and with whom Sayed had connected by social media, the cousin having settled near Buenos Aires. This cousin told Sayed that Sayed's father had passed away from pneumonia, a lingering infection he had fought for months, initially just a cold, but then much worse. And in the absence of antibiotics, he had succumbed. But he had not been alone. His siblings were with him, and he had been buried next to his wife, as he had wished. Sayed did not know how to mourn, how to express his remorse from so great a distance. So he redoubled his work and took on extra shifts, even when he barely had the strength. And the wait for Nadia and him to receive their dwelling did not shorten, but it likewise did not increase. For other husbands and wives and mothers and fathers and men and women were working extra shifts as well, and Sayed's additional efforts served to maintain his and Nadia's ranking on the list. Nadia was deeply affected by the news of the old man's passing, more even than she had expected. She tried to speak to Sayed about his father, but she stumbled over what to say, and on his side, Sayed was quiet, unforthcoming. She felt herself touched by guilt from time to time, although she was unsure what precisely was making her guilty. All she knew was that when the feeling came, it was a relief for her to be away from Sayed, at work on their separate work sites, a relief unless she thought about it, thought about being relieved not to be with him, because when she thought about this, the guilt was usually not too far behind. Sayed did not ask Nadia to pray with him for his father, and she did not offer. But when he was gathering a circle of acquaintances to pray in the long evening shadow cast by their dormitory, she said she would like to join the circle, to sit with Sayed and the others, even if not engaged in supplication herself. and he smiled and said there was no need, and she had no answer to this. But she stayed anyway, next to Sayyid on the naked earth that had been stripped of plants by hundreds of thousands of footsteps and rutted by the tires of ponderously heavy vehicles, feeling for the first time unwelcome, or perhaps unengaged, or perhaps both. For many, adjustment to this new world was difficult indeed, but for some, it was also unexpectedly pleasant. On Prinsengracht, in the center of Amsterdam, an elderly man stepped out onto the balcony of his little flat, one of the dozens into which what had been a pair of centuries-old canal houses and former warehouses had been converted. These flats looking out into a courtyard that was as lush with foliage as a tropical jungle, wet with greenness in this city of water. And moss grew on the wooden edges of his balcony, and ferns also, and tendrils climbed up its sides. And there he had two chairs from ages ago, when there were two people living in his flat, though now there was one, his last lover having left him bitterly. And he sat down on one of these chairs and delicately rolled himself a cigarette, his fingers trembling, the paper crisp, but with a hint of softness from the damp. And the tobacco smell reminded him, as it always did, of his departed father, who would listen with him on his record player to audio recordings of science fiction adventures, and would pack and puff on his pipe. As sea creatures attacked a great submarine, the sounds of the wind and waves in the recording mixing with the sounds of the rain on their window. And the elderly man, who was then a boy, had thought, "When I grow up, I too will smoke." And here he was, a smoker for the better part of a century, about to light a cigarette, when he saw, emerging from the common shed in the courtyard, where garden tools and the like were stored, and from which a steady stream of foreigners now came and went, a wrinkled man, with a squint and a cane and a Panama hat, dressed as though for the tropics. The elderly man looked at this wrinkled man and did not speak. He merely lit his cigarette and took a puff. The wrinkled man did not speak either. He walked slowly around the courtyard, leaning into his cane, which made scraping noises in the gravel of the footpath. Then the wrinkled man moved to re-enter the shed. But before he left, he turned to the elderly man, who was looking at him with a degree of disdain, and elegantly doffed his hat. The elderly man was taken aback by this gesture, and sat still, as if transfixed. And before he could think of how to respond, the wrinkled man stepped forward and was gone. The next day the scene repeated itself. The elderly man was sitting on his balcony. The wrinkled man returned. They gazed upon each other. And this time, when the wrinkled man doffed his hat, the elderly man raised a glass to him, a glass of fortified wine, which he happened to be drinking, and he did so with a serious but well-mannered nod of his head. Neither man smiled. On the third day, the elderly man asked the wrinkled man if he would care to join him on his balcony. And though the elderly man could not speak Brazilian Portuguese, and the wrinkled man could not speak Dutch, they cobbled together a conversation with many long gaps, but these gaps were eminently comfortable, almost unnoticed by the two men, as two ancient trees would not notice a few minutes or hours that passed without a breeze. On his next visit, the wrinkled man invited the elderly man to come with him through the black door that was inside the shed. The elderly man did so, walking slowly, as the wrinkled man did as well, and at the other side of that door, the elderly man found himself being helped to his feet by the wrinkled man in the hilly neighborhood of Santa Teresa in Rio de Janeiro, on a day that was noticeably younger and warmer than the day he had left in Amsterdam. There the wrinkled man escorted him over tram tracks to the studio where he worked and showed him some of his paintings, and the elderly man was too caught up in what was happening to be objective, but he thought these paintings were marked by real talent. He asked if he might buy one, and was instead given his choice as a gift. A week later, a war photographer who lived in a Prinsengracht flat that overlooked the same courtyard was the first neighbor to note the presence of this aged couple on the balcony opposite and below her. She was also, not long after, and to her considerable surprise, a witness to their very first kiss, which she captured, without expecting to, through the lens of her camera, and then deleted later that night, in a gesture of uncharacteristic sentimentality and respect. Sometimes, someone from the press would descend on, say, the Nadia's camp or worksite. But more often, denizens would themselves document and post and comment online upon what was going on. As usual, disasters attracted the most outside interest, such as a nativist raid that disabled machinery or destroyed dwelling units nearing completion, or resulted in the severe beating of some workers who had strayed too far from camp. Or alternatively, the knifing of a native foreman by a migrant or a fight among rival groups of migrants. But mostly there was little to report, just the day-to-day goings-on of countless people working and living and aging and falling in and out of love, as is the case everywhere, and so not deemed worthy of headline billing or thought to be of much interest to anyone but those directly involved. No natives lived in the dormitories, for obvious reasons. But natives did labor alongside migrants on the work sites, usually as supervisors or as operators of heavy machinery, giant vehicles that resembled mechanized dinosaurs and would lift vast amounts of earth or roll flat, hot strips of paving or churn concrete with the slow serenity of a masticating cow. Seth had, of course, seen construction equipment before, but some of what he saw now dwarfed in scale anything he had previously seen. And in any case, to work alongside a heaving and snorting building engine is not the same as glimpsing one from a distance. Just as for an infantryman, it is a markedly different experience to run alongside a tank in battle than it is for a child to watch one on parade. Seth worked on a road crew. His foreman was a knowledgeable and experienced native with a few short tufts of white hair wringing a mostly bald scalp that was covered by his helmet unless he was wiping away sweat at the end of the day. This foreman was fair and strong and had a stark, afflicted countenance. He did not make small talk, but unlike many of the natives, he ate his lunch among the migrants who labored under him. And he seemed to like Seth. Or if like was too strong a word, he seemed at least to value Seth's dedication. And often he sat next to Seth as he ate. Seth also had the added advantage of being among those workers who spoke English, and so occupied a status midway between the foreman and the others on the team. The team was a very large one, there being a surfeit of able bodies and a shortage of machinery. And the foreman was constantly devising methods of using so many people efficiently. In some ways, he felt he was caught between the past and the future. The past, because when he had first started his career, the balance of tasks had similarly tipped more towards manual labor. And the future, because when he looked around him now at the almost unimaginable scale of what they were undertaking, he felt they were remodeling the earth itself. Seth admired his foreman, the foreman having that sort of quiet charisma that young men often gravitate towards, part of which lay in the native man's not seeming the least interested in being admired. Also, for Seth and for many others on the team, their contact with the foreman was the closest and most extended of their contacts with any native, and so they looked at him as though he was the key to understanding their new home, its people and manners and ways and habits. Which in a sense he was, though of course their very presence here meant that its people and manners and ways and habits were undergoing considerable change. One time, as evening approached and the work for the day wound down, Seth went up to his foreman and thanked him for all he was doing for the migrants. The foreman did not say anything. In that instant, Seth was reminded of those soldiers he had seen in the city of his birth, returning on leave from battle, who, when you pestered them for stories about where they had been and what they had done, looked at you as if you had no idea how much you were asking. Seth woke before dawn the next day, his body tight and stiff. He tried not to move, out of consideration for Nadia, but opened his eyes and realized she was awake. His first instinct was to pretend he was still sleeping. He was exhausted, after all, and could have used more time undisturbed in bed. But the thought of her lying there and feeling alone was not a pleasant one, and besides, she might have noticed the subterfuge. So he turned to her and asked, in a whisper, "Do you want to go outside?" She nodded without gazing at him, and each of them rose and sat with their back to the other, on opposite sides of the cot, and fumbled in the dimness with their feet for their work boots. Laces rasped as they were cinched and tied. They could hear breathing and coughing and a child crying and the struggling sound of quiet sex. The pavilion's muted night lighting was about the intensity of a crescent moon, enough to allow sleep, but also enough to see shapes, though not colors. They made their way outside. The sky had begun to change and was less dark now than indigo, and there were others scattered around, other couples and groups, but mostly solitary figures, unable to sleep, or at least unable to sleep any longer. It was cool but not cold, and Nadia and Said stood side by side and did not hold hands, but felt the gentle pressure of their arms together through their sleeves. "I'm so tired this morning," Nadia said. "I know," said Said. "So am I." Nadia wanted to say more to Said than that, but just then her throat felt raw, almost painful. And what else she would have liked to say was unable to find a way through to her tongue and her lips. Said also had things on his mind. He knew he could have spoken to Nadia now. He knew he should have spoken to Nadia now, for they had time and were together and were not distracted. But he likewise could not bring himself to speak. And so they walked instead, Said taking the first step and Nadia following, and then both striding abreast each other at a good clip so that those who saw them saw what looked like a brace of workers marching and not a couple out on a stroll. The camp was desolate at this hour, but there were birds out and about, a great many birds, flying or perched upon the pavilions and the perimeter fence. And Nadia and Said looked at these birds who had lost or would soon lose their trees to construction, and Said sometimes called out to them with a faint, sibilant, unpuckered whistle, like a balloon slowly deflating. Nadia watched to see if any bird noticed his call, and did not on their walk see even one. Nadia worked on a mostly female crew that laid pipe, colossal spools and pallets of it in different colors, orange and yellow and black and green. Through these pipes soon would run the lifeblood and thoughts of the new city, all those things that connect people without requiring them to move. Ahead of the pipe layers was a digging machine, like a wolf spider or praying mantis, with a wide stance but a pair of dangerous-looking appendages at its front, coming together in a crenellated scraper near where its mouth would have been. This digging machine carved the trenches in the earth into which the pipe layers would unfurl and unstack and lower and connect the pipes. The driver of the digging machine was a portly native man with a non-native wife, a woman who looked native to Nadia, but had apparently arrived from a nearby country 2 decades ago, and who quite possibly had retained a trace of her ancestral accent. But then again, the natives had so many different accents that it was impossible for Nadia to say. This woman worked nearby as a supervisor in one of the food preparation units, and she would come to Nadia's worksite on her lunch break when her husband was there, which was not always, because he dug trenches for multiple pipe-laying crews. And then the woman and her husband would unwrap sandwiches and unscrew thermoses and eat and chat and laugh. As time passed, Nadia and some of the other women on her crew began to join them, for they were welcoming of company. The driver revealed himself to be a chatterbox and jokester, and relished the attention, and his wife seemed to relish it equally, though she spoke less. But she appeared to enjoy all these women listening and rapt to her husband. Perhaps this made him grow in stature in her own eyes. Nadia, who watched and smiled and usually said little in these gatherings, thought the couple a bit like the queen and king of a domain populated otherwise solely by women, a transient domain that would last only a few short seasons. And she wondered if perhaps they thought the same and had decided, nonetheless, to savor it. It was said that with every month there were more worker camps around London. But even if this were true, Said and Nadia noticed an almost daily swelling of their own camp with new arrivals. Some came on foot, others in buses or vans. On their days off, workers were encouraged to help out around the camp, and Said often volunteered to help process and settle the camp's latest additions. Once he handled a small family, a mother, father, and daughter, three people whose skin was so fair that it seemed they had never seen the sun. He was struck by their eyelashes, which held the light improbably, and by their hands and cheeks, in which networks of tiny veins could be seen. He wondered where they came from, but he did not speak their language, and they did not speak English, and he did not want to pry. The mother was tall and narrow-shouldered, as tall as the father, and the daughter was a slightly smaller version of her mother, nearly equal to Said in height, though he suspected she was still very young, likely just 13 or 14. They watched him with suspicion and in desperation, and Said was careful to speak softly and move slowly, as one does when meeting a nervous horse or puppy for the first time. During the course of the afternoon he spent with them, Said only rarely heard them speak to one another in what he thought of as their odd language. Mostly they communicated by gesture or with their eyes. Maybe, Said thought initially, they feared he might be able to understand them. Later he suspected something else, that they were ashamed, and that they did not yet know that shame for the displaced was a common feeling, and that there was, therefore, no particular shame in being ashamed. He took them to their designated space in one of the new pavilions, unoccupied and basic, with a cot and some fabric shelving hanging from one of the cables, and he left them there to settle in, left the three of them staring and motionless. But when he returned an hour later to bring them to the mess tent for lunch and called out, and the mother pushed aside the flap that served as their front door, and he glimpsed inside, what he glimpsed was a home, with the shelves all full, and neat bundles of belongings on the ground, and a throw on the cot, and also on the cot the daughter, her back unsupported but erect, her legs crossed at the shins so that her thighs rested on her feet, and in her lap a little notebook or diary in which she was writing furiously until the last moment, until the mother called out her name, and which she then locked with a key that she wore on a string around her neck and placed in one of the piles of belongings that must have been hers, thrust the diary into the middle of the pile so that it was hidden. She fell in behind her parents, who nodded at Said in recognition, and he turned and led them all from that place, a place that was already beginning to be theirs, to another where going forward they could reliably find a meal. The northern summer evenings were endless. Said and Nadia often fell asleep before it was fully dark, and before they fell asleep, they often sat outside on the ground, with their backs to the dormitory, on their phones, wandering far and wide, but not together, even though they appeared to be together. And sometimes he or she would look up and feel on their face the wind blowing through the shattered fields all about them. They put their lack of conversation down to exhaustion, for by the end of the day they were usually so tired they could barely speak, and phones themselves have the innate power of distancing one from one's physical surroundings, which accounted for part of it. But Said and Nadia no longer touched each other when they lay in bed, not in that way, and not because their curtained-off space in the pavilion seemed less than entirely private, or not only because of that. And when they did speak at length, they, a pair once not used to arguing, tended to argue, as though their nerves were so raw that extended encounters evoked a sensation of pain. Every time a couple moves, they begin, if their attention is still drawn to one another, to see each other differently, for personalities are not a single immutable color, like white or blue, but rather illuminated screens, and the shades we reflect depend much on what is around us. So it was with Said and Nadia, who found themselves changed in each other's eyes in this new place. To Nadia, Said was, if anything, more handsome than he had been before, his hard work and his gauntness suiting him, giving him a contemplative air, making out of his boyishness a man of substance. She noticed other women looking at him from time to time, and yet she herself felt strangely unmoved by his handsomeness, as though he were a rock or a house, something she might admire, but without any real desire. He had two or three white hairs in the stubble of his beard now, new arrivals this summer, and he prayed more regularly, every morning and evening, and perhaps on his lunch breaks too. When he spoke of paving and positions on waiting lists and politics, but not of his parents, and not any more of travel, of all the places they might one day see together, or of the stars. He was drawn to people from their country, both in the labor camp and online. It seemed to Nadia that the farther they moved from the city of their birth, through space and through time, the more he sought to strengthen his connection to it, tying ropes to the air of an era that for her was unambiguously gone. To Said, Nadia looked much the same as she did when they first met, which is to say, strikingly fetching, if vastly more tired. But it was inexplicable that she continued to wear her black robes, and it grated on him a bit, for she did not pray, and she avoided speaking their language, and she avoided their people, and sometimes he wanted to shout, "Well, take it off then." And then he would wince inwardly, since he believed he loved her, and his resentment, when it bubbled up like this, made him angry with himself, with the man he seemed to be becoming, a less than romantic man, which was not the sort of man he believed a man should aspire to be. Said wanted to feel for Nadia what he had always felt for Nadia, and the potential loss of this feeling left him unmoored, adrift in a world where one could go anywhere but still find nothing. He was certain that he cared for her and wished good for her and wanted to protect her. She was the entirety of his close family now, and he valued family above all, and when the warmth between them seemed lacking, his sorrow was immense, so immense that he was uncertain whether all his losses had not combined into a core of loss. And in this core, this center, the death of his mother and the death of his father and the possible death of his ideal self who had loved his woman so well, were like a single death that only hard work and prayer might allow him to withstand. Said made it a point to smile with Nadia, at least sometimes, and he hoped she would feel something warm and caring when he smiled. But what she felt was sorrow, and the sense that they were better than this, and that together they had to find a way out. And so when she suggested one day, out of the blue, under the drone-crossed sky, and in the invisible network of surveillance that radiated out from their phones, recording and capturing and logging everything, that they abandon this place and give up their position on the housing list and all they had built here and passed through a nearby door she had heard of to the new city of Marin on the Pacific Ocean close to San Francisco. He did not argue or even resist, as she thought he might, and instead he said yes. And both of them were filled with hope, hope that they would be able to rekindle their relationship, to reconnect with their relationship, as it had been not long ago, and to elude, through a distance spanning a third of the globe, what it seemed in danger of becoming. Chapter 10. In Marin, the higher up the hills one went, the fewer services there were, but the better the scenery. Nadia and Said were relative latecomers to this new city, and the lower slopes were all taken, and so they found a spot high up, with a view across and through the Golden Gate Bridge, of San Francisco and the bay, when it was clear, and a view of scattered islands floating on a sea of clouds, when the fog rolled in. They assembled a shanty with a corrugated metal roof and discarded packing crate sides. This, as their neighbors had explained, was earthquake-friendly. It might fall in a tremor, but it was unlikely to do its occupants too much harm, because of its relatively light weight. Wireless data signals were strong, and they secured a solar panel and battery set with a universal outlet, which accepted plugs from all around the world, and a rainwater collector, fashioned from synthetic fabric and a bucket, and dew collectors that fit inside plastic bottles like the filaments of upside-down light bulbs. And so life, while basic, was not quite as rough, nor as cut off, as otherwise it might have been. From their shanty, the fog was a living thing, moving, thickening, slipping, thinning out. It revealed the invisible, what was happening in the water and in the air, for suddenly heat and cold and damp could not merely be felt on one's skin, but be seen through their atmospheric effects. It seemed to Nadia and Said that somehow they lived at once on the